Welcome to our Whole Person Healthcare podcast, rather cheekily named When the Drugs Don't Work. My name's Karen Lindsay. I'm a immunologist and rheumatologist, a physician at Auckland City Hospital. Brian Broome's a immunologist. Although he's retired from the hospital, he's still practicing as a psychotherapist, working in a whole person way. And we're having a series of conversations which hopefully will be helpful to people who want to treat people in a whole person way. So welcome. If you're interested in our website, it's http://wholeperson.healthcare. And welcome. I'm Karen Lindsay. I'm a rheumatology doctor and Brian's an immunology doctor. And we practice whole person healthcare. And we're very conscious that people don't know what that is. And so we're going to try and explain it in our first podcast. What on earth is a whole person approach? For someone who has never heard of it.
That's where we should start.
I think so. But they've obviously come to, they have some curiosity that's brought them to this point.
Yes, well, I guess I've explained this many times and in many ways to many patients and to many clinicians. And there's no one way of explaining it. Patients resonate with the idea of whole persons very well because intuitively they know that they are whole persons. Clinicians wonder what on earth we're talking about.
Yes.
I guess it goes back to the fact that, for me anyway, that I was a physician who then trained for some years in psychiatry and then psychotherapy and then put the two together. And as I did that, and sitting there with these two disciplines sort of active inside me and being expressed in some way or other with patients, I started listening and hearing about things that in the past as an immunologist I hadn't heard or even tried to listen to, or if they had come up, I wouldn't have seen any significance to it.
That's right.
And in particular, as I got interested in these extra bits and pieces, which I subsequently called stories, I realised that actually some of these stories fitted the illness so perfectly that why would we exclude them? And particularly, and I don't want to get too complicated at the moment, particularly the illnesses that seem to almost say the same story as the story, as the life event or the feeling, set of feelings that the person was expressing. So, again, I'm still dealing a little bit with the history of it. So I started to think about medicine and story, physical illnesses and the stories that came with the patients. And I don't know how much detail I should go into at this stage, but what I found over the years was that if I dealt with the story, sometimes the illness would disappear, the physical illness would disappear or get better, or the patient would manage the illness rather differently. And so what this led to, and this is quite important, is why do we keep the physical illness and the emotional experience and life events of the person or the patient with the physical illness apart? And that led to a much longer development of understanding that actually people were not divided.
Right.
People are not fragmented.
Yeah.
That physical illness is not separate from the person's life. And of course patients know this, but they are captive to a medical system which is what we call very dualistic.
Yeah.
Now I need to explain that quickly. And that is that the mind and body are kept separate.
Mm.
So we have the tradition of the real diseases that don't have anything to do with one story or life experience. And we have the psychosomatic disorders. And that's all based on this division. Mm. But we actually don't see patients as divided. We see them as whole persons, which then raises the issue of how do we do stuff, medical work, and allow both of these into the same space.
Mm.
So whole person healthcare is about allowing that to happen and becoming reasonably skilled at not only allowing it to happen, but to facilitate it.
Mm. And you said sort of dealing with the story factors.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? You know, like that's facilitation.
Yeah.
How does that happen? What do you have to do?
Well, I think the first thing that has to happen is inside the head of the clinician.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that there has to be an acceptance that because mind and body, or what we call mind and body, what I would say, all things physical and all things subjective,
yeah,
are not separate. But they emerge from birth entangled together, belonging together, never apart. They emerge and they're there all the way through, and they both develop. The body develops, the ability of the body develops, the story, the ability of the patient to experience and put it in language, all those kinds of things.
Self-regulation of emotions,
yeah, all of that.
Naming things and expressing yourself, and
yep.
Being in relationship,
yep.
With
yep.
yourself and others.
Yeah.
All that stuff falls co-emergent.
Yep, it's co-emergent. It's together. It is never apart.
No.
And yet we've excluded that whole field of story information from illness.
Mm.
And of course it's quite, we can deal with that in other moments, but it's quite terrifying to bring them together for many people because of the seriousness of some illnesses. So
yeah.
That's an issue but of management. But I think your question was, well, how do we bring the story into the session, allow it to be there, how we approach it?
Yes, but also, like, how do you go about trying to deal with it and make it better?
Well, as I said, and I think I'm coming back on track again, the first thing is that the clinician has to change something in his or her head, which is that it's true that actually the mind and body, the story and the illness, are there together. They belong together and they need to be recognised. Now, you can't recognise something if you don't even entertain the possibility of it.
Yeah.
Now, that's the clinician. So the next step is how to introduce that to patients.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clinicians say, oh, yeah, but the patient will be terrified, the patient will react, the patient won't like it, whatever. I don't think that's true if one's a skilled story collector.
Yeah.
Actually, the patients know their whole, and one of their biggest complaints in modern medicine is that they're treated not as whole.
Mm, and no one listens.
And no one listens. Mm. So that's a big story in itself. So the second thing is how to introduce it to the person. And the way I do it is I say right at the start of virtually every consultation in one way or another, I say. In introducing myself, I like to see people as a whole. I believe that people are not divided, that I'm going to be interested in both their physical and non-physical elements.
Mm-hmm.
And if we put it in that way, which is the way I actually feel, most people will say, "Oh, that's good. That sounds good." As if I've never heard anything quite like that.
It's a revelation.
It's a revelation, yes. So the patients are not really the problem, though the doctors say the patients will be a problem.
No.
The problem is in medicine or clinical healthcare, because we have based the whole thing on the division of the person.
And it's almost systematically been excluded, hasn't it?
Yes, it's become a systemic thing.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
The way that we talk, the way we build our buildings, the way we name departments.
That's right.
The way we have appointments.
That's right.
It's all built around the mind and the body being
sick. And the way we diagnose.
Yeah.
The way we label.
And the way we treat.
The way we treat.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess following, can I just come in there? I guess following your question or tracking the school thing or what you do thing occurs and has to change inside the clinician's head or the healthcare worker's head. It has to change. We have to change our assumptions about illness and about the patient and what the patient will absorb. We then have to educate the patient, because the patient has actually been absorbed into a system of division.
Yeah.
And so they might get a little bit startled if they think we're going to ask them about their story, and in fact, the story things do tend to be rather sensitive kinds of material, and therefore a bit frightening. So if you're not a good educator and you're not good at holding the clinical relationship sensitively and empathically, it's going to get clunky and jerky and difficult.
Mm.
But that shouldn't be seen purely as the patient's problem.
Mm.
It can be seen as a wider societal problem, assuming that everything can be fixed mechanically in illness. It can be a problem of the clinician not having the relational skills, or maybe having the relational skills but not having the right model in his head, his or her head.
Yeah, or having the skills, having the model, but not having the time because of the system.
Yeah, this one comes up again and again. I don't have the time.
I don't have time.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't have the skills.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't have the model.
Yeah.
So I don't have the outcomes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm busy enough as it is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it becomes, at base, and I'm going to be a bit extreme about this. At base, the problem here is one of truth and ethics.
Mm.
If it's true that we're not divided, how can we persist in dividing the patient? Now, I know from experience that some clinicians will say, "I know this is right, but I'm not going to do it."
Yeah.
Because that's not what I signed up for.
I think that is the response I got from some colleagues when I gave my talk to the rheumatologists. One of them was like, "Yeah, we completely accept this."
But?
When, you know, there was no necessarily any decision to make any changes.
No.
And there was a look. I don't think, you know, I think it can be dangerous because we don't have the skills, which we've mentioned, the skills are important.
And then aside from that, there's just a whole lot of shock, sort of silence.
Yeah.
So people obviously are individual in the way they respond to these sorts of suggestions. But we are talking about absolute beginners here.
Yes. I think we do need to recognise that changing, for individuals to change their way of practising when everything's been set up to divide the patient is actually a big challenge, and particularly for clinicians who are working in institutional systems where there's a lot of external pressure and control and collegial or fear of collegial resistance and criticism. I think that's a given. But at the same time, and I think where individuals are working in private practice, they perhaps have a slightly easier task, though, or a significantly easier task, because they're less sort of constrained by the obvious structural limitations of a hospital's throughput type issues and so on. But that's the sort of practicality of it. But the other thing is that most people have got a huge investment in their trainings, their careers, their collegial recognition and support, their financial viability. There's a huge investment in not doing anything differently. I mean, a lot of clinicians want to be good clinicians. That's not what I'm questioning. What they don't want is a system that unsettles their whole way of doing things.
I do feel like I'm potentially, you know, causing some harm whenever I bring these ideas up.
Well, you're causing trouble.
Causing trouble, yeah.
Yes. What sort of harm do you think it is?
Well, they can't just get on with it.
Well, getting on with it, we know in a lot of chronic conditions, getting on with it is actually getting on with harm. Well,
it's not improving things.
Not improving things, and sometimes poisoning things.
Yeah.
Not that I'm against, as you know, I'm not at all against useful, safe and effective medications.
No, I mean, we're talking about the best of both worlds here, hopefully, one day.
Yeah, we are.
Where we've got the best of biomedicine and the best of what we're talking about, the bit that's been left behind.
Yeah.
Because subjectivity has been undervalued, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
When you say the word story,
yeah.
I mean, people probably roll their eyes in their head and think, oh, well, what's that got to do with anything?
Well,
because it's subjective.
Well, yes, but we are subjective. We are. We're very storied and meaning-making and emotional and relational. I mean, I just find it very hard to tolerate the notion that a story is warm, fuzzy and ridiculous to be interested in. I think that's incredibly devaluing of the human being.
And also people say, oh, well, the meaning's been made retrospectively and you're trying to force the meaning on this situation which might not be there.
Well, they could say that, I suppose.
If they'd even bothered to ask.
Yes, yes. I think, I could get sort of cranky about that and say, well, actually, we're forcing patterns of recognition on our patients all the time.
Yeah.
We're assuming that they're mechanistic structures, that a label like chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia or rheumatoid arthritis, because it's a pattern that all the clinicians will recognise as having a pattern, it's valid for that reason. But actually, it may not be the best way of understanding what the emergence of this disease is about.
And I think it's quite hard to explain to a colleague, look, I've heard this story and I've heard this disease and they seem in some way in me to make sense.
Yeah.
So it's the timing.
Yeah.
It's the language. It's the non-response to medication. There's a match here, and it makes sense to me. You know, once you've been through this experience of doing the whole, treating the whole person, and that there is some kind of congruence between what's going on, but that's something you can't prove. You see, the undervaluing of subjectivity that matches the physicality is also part of the problem, because in a way, you're, you know, it's your subjectivity which is the evidence.
Mm. I think all of that takes an elaborate working through and talking through. I'd make some obvious points. One is that if you get a patient who, well, I'll just give an example, a woman who presented with 15 years of severe migraine. How do you attach a story to that?
Mm.
And what no one had asked was when it first began.
Mm.
It first began when she was 13, 14, when her father died of a brain tumour.
Mm.
She had a headache for about 6 months, and then it disappeared. Then at 16, she had her first boyfriend, who then abandoned her for her best friend,
mm.
and she got headaches again for about 6 months. And then at age 21, she got pregnant to a young fellow who absconded to Australia and left her stranded, and she got headaches for 15 years.
Mm.
Now, is that all in my imagination? You know, you have to ask yourself, the correlations there are quite powerful, and they're no different to the kind of history taking that we take when we ask about the body.
Mm-hmm.
Except that when we ask about the body, we don't ask about that correlation. We ask about the correlation with our physical diagnostic system. Mm. We accept that as valid. We have tests for it. We don't have tests for the story.
No.
I think that's one thing, Karen. The echo, I often look for evidence throughout the lifespan of the emergence of illness and the emergence of new lots of symptoms or occasions of symptoms relating to various stress events, and see what the echoes,
mm.
the patterns are.
And you're getting a feeling for the person.
Yes, but I'm testing it out, because if in fact it occurs on one event but not another event that's like it, then I think, well, you know, what's the difference? And so you need to be as probing and as careful and as non-trigger happy around making a kind of story diagnosis, as you are careful and non-trigger happy about making a physical diagnosis.
That's right, But at the end of the day, it's an inner knowing that you get, as much as you can ever know another person. And it's tried out in the relationship.
Well, isn't it? I think the knowing has to do with, just like an ordinary clinical medicine, if we're a good story taker and a good listener, and we start to hear these correlations and they resonate with the person, the patient, confidence is gradually growing that this connection is really important.
Mm.
You then think, well, what are we going to do?
Yes.
And it may well be that all we have to do is make the connection for the patient, and they go away and they say, actually, some of them say, I'd been thinking that all along, but I've never told anybody because the system doesn't believe that actually those connections exist.
I've definitely had that experience a lot. that people already know, or they just half know, and they kind of thrilled to be told that they're right.
And that sort of legitimizes, validates, empowers them to go off and do something about this. Well, the better, those that have it easier, that's a possibility that they will next time, I went to talk to my boss, or I spoke to my husband who goes off duck shooting or hunting every weekend, you know, and I'm left stranded with the children. And that's sort of when my symptoms get bad. So, I mean, we could tell lots of stories about that, but I think we're talking principles here at the moment.
We are, but we're also trying to make the point of why it's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, what is the whole point?
Which is the next thing, that if we can work with the person, will they or won't they get better?
Yes.
And I think the other thing, and I didn't say it before, but I had it in mind, I was talking about the echoes, the repeat patterns of relationship with physical distress or physical symptomatology or a worsening of the disorder in relation to the same kind of stress, that echo thing. But the second thing that has convinced me over the years is that when you make these connections and the patient responds and they find that actually these things make sense to them and then they work on it, patients who have been unwell with chronic disease, maybe for years, get better. And against all the odds and against all the treatments they've had.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think it is difficult to, you know, standard medicine is based on large groups and diagnoses. So you pull out of the population 100 people with asthma. You basically essentialize all these people around a label that you've given them.
Yeah.
And certain types of symptoms, so all asthmatics are breathless at times, they're wheezy, and they have certain lung function tests that are impaired. So you draw out 100 of these people and you assume they're all the same because you've got them age matched and so on. All their stories are invisible. And then you divide them into groups and you give 50 a placebo and 50 the new drug of whatever sort. And you show that people on placebo get 30% improvement or 35 or 37, which is about standard for placebo responses. And the others get 55. So actually the drug works. It relieves. It might be that it relieves the spasm, or it might be that it prevents an allergic response and spasm, whatever, whatever. The story is excluded. Now, how do you do that with 100 people who've all got stories? How do you make that? How do you do a study like that? And it would be possible to do a study with huge resources, but actually that's extremely difficult in our system of funding of research.
To get funding for.
Yes. But, I mean, asthma is... asthma is of great interest to me because of the way in which very severe, precipitous asthma can... I've seen stories in these people... maybe we shouldn't talk about it at the moment, but it is great concern to me that we have asthmatics who are recurrently admitted to hospital who have near-fatal episodes and whose story is not examined. And that's from my experience.
No, I think that's highly relevant, actually, because that's really why we're advocating for this approach. You know, it's a kind of emergency.
Yes.
Even though it's hard to study, it's something that's real. It's a real phenomenon, and that we're missing it all. You know, we're missing it. So I think it is kind of crucial.
That's
And it's if that's because we've isolated one condition, what about all conditions?
From a principal perspective, whole person healthcare should apply to everybody.
Mm.
But clearly, if someone has fallen down a cliff and are hypotensive and they need pulling out by a helicopter and going to intensive care.
And that's where it's at its best, isn't it, biomedicine
at its best.
Although even actually, I'm not sure it is, because a lot of people who do go through very acute and traumatic surgeries and experiences still feel quite alienated because they haven't been treated like a person.
I think that's true. I think in terms of what we would call in medicine or in military sense, triage, where do you put your priorities?
Yeah.
You have to resuscitate a person before you talk to them about their story or even consider it. But when it comes to many conditions, chronic conditions, I think it's unethical. No, I mean, if we regard a person with a history of, say, 2 decades of recurrent urinary infections, I discover at the end of 2 decades by asking her that it followed being sexually abused, and no one has asked her. What was going on at the time it started?
Mm.
What was going on when it got worse?
Mm.
I think that's negligent.
Mm.
And there's a question of ethics here.
Mm.
Now, if I were to say this to, say, a lot of GPs who've got that kind of situation, I think some would actually go and ask.
Yeah.
So some of it is about getting permission to even think that there might be a connection.